Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Solaria Report. Today is the last day of August. We're recording Wednesday, the 31st. The fall begins shortly. We're coming into Labor Day. We'll publish this on the first day of September. And it's John Titus and Catherine Austin Fitz. Our theme reflects big changes underway. Tell them the theme, John.
Yeah, well, it's the happy part of the theme. It's the blinkers are coming off. Meaning the blinders are coming off the general public. But at the same
friction,
time,
the friction is rising like crazy.
The powers of V are going bonkers. I think because the blinders are coming off, they're doubling down on everything. There's like, well, it's not working. We need more.
Well, but they're not only doubling down on the general population, they're fighting among themselves. So the tension is just off the charts.
Tensions run high, yes.
Well, it's funny. Right now I'm in Switzerland, so I'm in Arlesheim right outside of Basel. And when I got here on Sunday, somebody said, "Did you realize the Zionist conference is meeting for 2 days?" I said, "Oh God." Suddenly military helicopters go starting back and forth, and it's all in the paper. And for 2 days, God, it felt, I don't think I've ever, you know, it's a beautiful place where I am, but it's never felt more uncomfortable than the last. I don't know what was going on at the Zionist conference, but it was uncomfortable for sure. I'm sure they're making new plans for the Ukraine or something. I don't know. Anyway,
Well,
we got plenty of stories. So let's dive in.
Yeah. On that note of the Ukraine, let's go to our first story and our first segment, War in Ukraine. From Newsweek, U.S. Air Division deploying soldiers as Kremlin says Russia, NATO at war. Well, yeah, no kidding. They've been saying that a long time. We've been covering that a long time on Money Markets. And so here it is. Soldiers from a U.S. Air Assault Division that arrived in Europe in late July are being sent to NATO members in Eastern Europe to help protect the military alliance's eastern flank. And the reason given is Russia fuels concerns that its war could widen beyond Ukraine. Interesting. Let's see if there's a basis for that concern. The mission said that nearly 2,400 soldiers would be sent to NATO members, Romania, Bulgaria, Hungary, and Slovakia. So that's where they're going, to reassure our allies and deter our adversaries. What has Russia done to provoke this concern? Here's a quote from the Russian defense minister. "We understand very well that on the territory of Ukraine, we are not at war with Ukraine, and of course, not with Ukrainians. The entire NATO bloc is fighting a war against Russia on the territory of Ukraine and by the Ukrainians' hand." So we've covered this because we've covered things like, well, yeah, it is. It's got to be the West because they're using satellites. They're using drones that can only have a satellite link up, which Ukraine doesn't have. The Russians know what they're up against, but they're up against it in the Ukraine. There's nothing in this. It's like, well, you said that, so now we're going to move people all over Europe, even though there's no indication.
Well, especially when you look at 101st Airborne troops going into Hungary, are they going in there to protect Hungary from the Russians or to stop Hungary from trading with the Russians?
What's the real reason? The reason given is nonsense. It doesn't make sense.
Right.
Yeah.
Right, but it's get the more countries go into NATO and the more we send troops to NATO, the dicier it's going to get.
Right. The friction increases there. Increases everywhere. And meanwhile, you know, this is another thing we've covered on Money Markets. It's like, where's all this money going? And we have a report from Mark Skidmore, you know, Lighthouse Economics, most transparent administration in history, stops publishing military expenditures and arms transfers, according to a report. This week, the State Department announced that the World Military Expenditures and Arms Transfers Report, which has been published for over 50 years and is required by law, will no longer be produced. As usual, that provision was buried deep inside the National Defense Authorization Act for fiscal year 2022. So they've simply dispatched with the requirement of reporting, and now all the money is going to the black hole officially.
Right. And this is happening as we keep getting reports that the arms transferred to Ukraine are only stopping briefly in Ukraine and then transferring elsewhere. And I bring that up because one of the ways the money went missing from the DOD was literally arms being sold out from, you know, through the back door.
Right.
Just like the chef selling the food out of the back door of the restaurant, putting the money in his pocket.
Right.
You know, you have to ask, you know, where is the transfer? Where are the arms going and who's pocketing the cash?
Yeah.
It's beginning to look like a Nicolas Cage movie.
Right. It is. Right.
Right.
Okay. But it's remarkable the way the West and the Ukraine tends to they keep anticipating events in making like these preemptive moves as if their reading of the future, their reading of the tarot cards is gospel truth. And right. that's another one in our next story. It's like, well, who's really doing this? Next story, German economy minister says bitter reality is Russia will not resume gas supply. Russia will not restore gas supplies to the country, the German economic minister said on Monday. It won't come back. It is the bitter reality, Robert Habeck said in a panel with European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen. Russia will halt natural gas supplies to Europe for 3 days at the end of the month for unscheduled maintenance to the Nord Stream pipeline. But and so from that, you can it's never coming back. It sounds like Germany's doing that more than anybody else.
I'm sitting in Switzerland right now, and you see reports which are designed intentionally to scare people to death. So you have Germans all going into the forest and collecting up wood, literally.
Right.
And towns building stockpiles so they can heat the town with, you know, biomass. So, you know, I don't know how much of this is fear talk, but the pressure to persuade Europe that the end of the world is coming is very intense. I think there was one article I sent you where that reported 70% of the restaurants in the UK are going to have to close because they can't afford their utility bill. And the thing that's so strange about
70,
it is if you,
whoa,
70% of the restaurants. Now, if you look at people's utility bills, you know, we can send an infinite amount, you know, we can send hundreds of billions of dollars of arms to Ukraine, no problem. But average people can't pay their utility bill and there's no relief.
We're going to see that.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. The gulf, the widening divide between elites and everybody else. We're coming right up on that.
Right.
But let's turn to space military global turf wars. Because this story is interesting. And so there's the gulf between elites and everybody else. And then there's the gulf between East and West.
Right.
And this is an East-West gulf right here. BRICS president, Russia and India have no need for the U.S. dollar. BRICS International, the speaker here is BRICS International Forum president, Purnima Anand. Okay. We have implemented the mechanism of mutual settlements in rubles and rupees, and there is no need for our countries to use the dollar in mutual settlements. Russia state news agency, RIA, quoted Anand as saying. Anand said that a similar mechanism is being developed between Russia and China to eliminate the use of the greenback and employ only rubles and yuan. So in other words, the dollar is being cut out of settlement. Remember, in debt-based monetary systems, which are prevalent throughout the world, you have to settle because everybody's so-called money is really an IOU. And for one bank to accept another bank's IOUs or one country to accept another country's IOUs, you have to settle in an agreed-upon exchange. And now what India and Russia are saying is, no, we're not going to use the dollar to settle anymore. We've got our own way to settle.
Well, but what that means is the dollar doesn't have jurisdiction. If they use the dollar to settle, then the U.S. dollar asserts global jurisdiction. And now, one, they don't have the data, but two, they don't have jurisdiction. And one of the reasons that can work is if you're the Chinese and you're accepting, you know, you're paying in rubles and you have rubles, you're collecting rubles, you're making sales in rubles, you can use rubles to buy more oil and gas. So as long as you need oil and gas, there's always something you can buy from the Russians. And in a, you know, we're in a rising commodity market, so that's going to serve Russia well. And that means that trade can work.
Yeah. Well, so, the other backdrop to that is, what do you, if you're not settling in the dollar, what are you settling in? And I just would point out that those three countries are well-known traffickers in gold.
Right. Right. And producers.
And producers.
So China's one of the biggest producers.
Yeah.
Russia too.
Yeah.
Right.
So you got to wonder if that's really the backdrop.
I'm sure, because in, I think it was 2017 or 18, the Russian central bank set up an office in Beijing for gold trade.
Yeah.
So that they've been working on that infrastructure for years now.
Yeah.
5 years ago. Right.
That's how it's looking more and more like as the East breaks away from the West, it's like we're going to go with gold. I mean, that's my sort of read of the tea leaves. And to be clear, there's nothing expressed in that story. That is purely a hunch that I'm reciting there.
Right. But I don't think they're going to depend more and more on gold, and gold's going to be very central to what they do and how they do it. But it's not going to depend on gold. It's not going to be a big gold standard the way I think some people think.
Yeah, I don't think so either.
Because you've got major commodities trade. You know, if you look at, we've been in a bull market for technology and commodities coming down. That's going to turn, commodities going to go up. And if you look at the richness of trade back, you know, between China, Russia, and India in the commodities, it's going to be much more robust. Gold's going to be important, but it's not going to depend on gold the way it would if we were in a tech momentum environment. We're not in that kind of environment.
No, I don't think they're put all their eggs in one basket, but I would be shocked if gold were not in that mix. Whatever settlement is.
Oh, hugely.
Yeah.
Hugely.
I think so. Yeah. Okay. Next story. Keep it going. China has dumped treasuries for seventh straight month as it defends the yuan against the dollar. This is kind of interesting, you know, so seven straight months on a potential sign that Beijing is trying to defend the yuan against the dollar, because the dollar is on a tear, as we'll see later. We've been seeing for months. China, but look at these numbers. This is interesting. China's holdings of treasuries fell to $968 billion in June, down from $981 billion in May. Treasury data showed it holdings have dropped sharply from a year earlier when they stood at $1.06 trillion. So they're now below $1 trillion, which, you know, if you think about that, it's 30.
Way down from where it used to be.
Yeah, right.
They've been dropping for a long, long time.
Been dropping for a while. It used to be $2 trillion.
I remember when it was three.
Okay.
I think it hit three. But it's way, way down. And they've been trying to swap dollars for real assets for a long, long time.
But look, here we go. China is still a major foreign holder of U.S. Treasury, second only to Japan, the official's figure showed. So
if you saw that story I just sent you, the Japanese made a deal with Russia for LNG.
I didn't see that, no.
Yeah.
No.
It's as everybody lines up their energy supplies, the reality of the energy need is hitting home.
Yeah, right.
Yep.
Right.
Yep.
Yep. Okay, let's see. Last story in space military global turf wars. This one's interesting. Chinese companies on U.S. exchanges face 50% risk of delisting despite deals. So last Friday, the U.S. and China reached a preliminary deal, so it hadn't been inked yet, to move away from delisting hundreds of Chinese companies from U.S. stock exchanges. Over the weekend, the deal lowered the market's risk assessment from March's 95% risk of delisting to the present 50%, according to Goldman Sachs. That's where the 50% figure is coming from. If the deal goes through, it will neutralize the delisting threat injected by former President Trump when he signed the Foreign Holding Companies Accountable Act, which basically adds a whole lot of red tape right here. You can see this paragraph here. Under the act, some commission is in charge of identifying and singling out companies that have audits outside, and then it does all these things. And there's always these hoops to jump through. And now they're going to go away. But the market's like, well, you haven't inked the deal yet, so 50% chance.
So a couple things. We, several years ago on the Slayer Report, our movie of the week was The China Hustle, which shows you the extraordinary amount of fraud that was a real problem with Chinese companies. So there's some merit to this in the to the extent that the Chinese companies have been raising capital in the U.S. markets and not operating to the standard we might want. At the same time, it's very hard for anybody in America to accuse the Chinese of financial fraud.
Right. That's pretty rich, you know, after what we've seen.
Yeah. So if you look at how Asia got burnt on financial fraud and mortgage fraud, you know, it's the pot calling the kettle black. So there are two sides to this story. And the thing that's so painful to me is one of the things that makes for a peaceful world is when we can trade and share capital investment to each other. And the Anglo-American markets, both London and the US, have always been the richest, deepest equity markets. And to watch that tear apart, that tells you there really is a multipolar world. And, you know, I know investors who were sitting on Russian stocks when they went to zero, and they're still trying to hold and get them back, you know, to some kind of reasonable valuation. But when you see that tear, it doesn't, you know, what it hurts is it hurts real investors.
Yeah.
You know, right. Who have, I mean, it's really ugly to watch. And so seeing, we have a graph coming up later on the number of Chinese stocks in the market.
Right.
But you've got over $1 trillion market capitalization listed on the NASDAQ, the MX, or the New York Stock Exchange. You know, that's a big, I mean, it's certainly not, it's a small percentage, but $1 trillion is a lot of money. And I hate to see $1 trillion put under that kind of cloud. It's unnerving because what it means is, you know, I mean, I would never at this point buy a Chinese stock on the U.S. market. I don't want it, you know, I don't want it taken to zero by politics.
Yeah. There's a lot of risk now that there should be a risk of holding a bank account and protesting the wrong cause. You know, we saw that in Canada.
Right. Yeah. Right. Welcome to war.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, so welcome to lawlessness.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. The elites and the insiders are never getting burned by these things because they see it coming. They see the rule change coming. And it's like, oh, well, you know, we already knew about the delisting. So we dumped our Chinese stocks. We dumped our Russian stocks a long time ago. Sucker.
Right.
You know?
Right.
Yeah. Anyway. Okay, Fed Watch. You ready? Here we go.
Elites breaking away from everybody else.
Here we go.
Bloomberg.
U.S. corporate profits soar with margins at widest since 1950. That's a long time. After-tax profits as a share of gross value added for non-financial corporations, which is a measure of aggregate profit margins, improved in the second quarter to 15.5%, the most since 1950, from 14% in the first quarter, according to the Commerce Department. The data show that companies overall have comfortably been able to pass on their rising costs of materials and labor to consumers. But remember, that's non-financial companies.
Right. So my bet, if you look at that, we're looking at enormous amounts of money coming through the federal and DOD budget, number one. Number two, the stealing of market share on COVID-19. And number three, enormous amounts of money put into stock buybacks.
And
that's what
generated
that profit.
All occurring against the backdrop of, it seems in the U.S., seemingly every single market being an oligopoly of five or six firms.
Right. It's financial steroids is what it looks like to me. So I think that's why, you know, when I look at a company now, I really want to drill down. Where are those earnings real? Where are they coming from? Are they real?
Stock buybacks are a big part of that. There's no doubt about that.
Right. Right.
They're levering up with debt and they're turning around. They're plowing that money into shares.
Right.
You know, it's like, well, what
do you? Doesn't feel good.
It's really in this market, you're making record profits.
So remember, I don't know if you remember this, but during COVID, we had done that look at the riots. And how close they were.
Yeah.
You know, one, how close they were to the local Fed bank, but also how they related to the opportunity zones.
Right.
And one of the ones we looked at was on Lake Boulevard, right next
in
to
Minneapolis.
Your pal,
Neil Kashkari.
Right. And who's really been out and about lately. I don't know if you've noticed, but
I have. So, how have I not noticed?
So there was an article last week about a group of government officials going because there are all these new grants rolling in to help fix Lake Boulevard.
Yeah, right.
And you think, you know, that's what's showing up in corporate profits.
I finally figured out why Neil Kashkari, I find him so disturbing. Because he's an amalgam of two characters, okay?
Right.
He's a mix of Count Dracula and Gomer Pyle. And I find it very unsettling, very disturbing. Okay, FedWatch, let's keep it going. While corporate profits are reaching a high, for everybody else, not so good. Inside the worst ever crisis in late utility payments, some 20 million across the U.S., about 1 in 6 homes have fallen behind on their utility bills. It is, according to the National Energy Assistance Directors Association, the worst crisis the group has ever documented. Underpinning those numbers is a blistering surge in electricity prices propelled by the surging cost of natural gas. There you go. There's 123.6 million households in the U.S. 20 million of them are behind on utility payments. Wow.
Jesus. That's horrifying. If you look at the utility payments and you look at late payments on auto loans, including used auto loans.
Yeah.
I mean, you're literally looking at something similar to what we saw in that rent survey with businesses saying they didn't expect to make it to the end of the year and an extraordinary number of people, businesses being behind on their rent.
Yeah, right.
So what you're seeing is consumers, despite corporations saying that they can get their costs back, what we're seeing is consumers just going off a cliff. So something doesn't match up. It's not in alignment.
Something does not match up. Something does not match. I'm working on a video now. Sometimes it takes me a long time to finish the video because it's like, well, you got to go where the evidence takes you. And if it took me to an unexpected place, I'm like, what? Is this
right?
Yeah, there's a lot more money in pockets out there than you think.
Yes.
Yeah, because that remember that QE, the Fed added $4.5 trillion to retail bank accounts, and that's a lot of water in a flood system, and it's coming up through weird places.
Well, I showed you the draft of SPACs yesterday.
Yeah.
So the SPACs wrap up is going to the printer.
That looks great
next week. And you know, while many people can't pay their utility bill, there is a tsunami of money.
You're not kidding. There is a tsunami of money.
Yeah, the tsunami all lands at JP Morgan Chase. It's quite miraculous.
Yeah, well, they get their beak in that one for sure. Okay. Let's go on to keep it going in FedWatch. This next plant from Australia. So, you know, brace yourself. Decarbonizing Sydney.
Oh, this is so bad.
Okay, so this is a PDF. I can't highlight it, but I want to scroll down here just to give you a flavor for what is in store. Decarbonizing Sydney. It's right here on this page. You get a real sense of it. These things they're going to electrify Sydney's road transport, so electric vehicles are coming in, gas vehicles are going out, enhance residential and commercial building sustainability, increase uptake, distributed energy resources. I mean, it's all these very invasive things and invasive regulations, accelerate coal closures and enhance collaboration mechanisms. So the war is on against fossil fuels in Sydney, and it's they're taking it to the consumer level.
I have no idea how anybody who owns and manages real estate is going to adapt to that. It's,
you know, and Australia is a pretty warm climate.
Right.
So it would make sense that Mr. Global wants to roll it out. Try his little experiment in Australia first before moving on to sort of places where people might freeze to death.
Right.
Yeah. But there's energy cuts coming in Australia,
right?
For
but
sure.
If you combine those energy regulations with their tax collection grid, they have one of the most ferocious tax collection systems in the world.
Really?
So, yeah. So if you, I mean, this is technocracy. You know, this is technocratic war.
Yeah.
On the, you know, on asserting control of real assets. So it's going to be ferocious.
That PDF, that is a very extensive, detailed PDF.
Right.
Yeah, it's coming. They're not doing this right. For shits and giggles.
This is the end. So the end of property rights is not going to be simple. It's going to be by 1,000 cuts.
Yep.
That's what you have to understand. But yep. It's the end of property rights.
Oh, yeah. And we'll see another story coming right. up in the U.S. on that point,
like,
the end of property rights, big time. Okay, let's keep it going. The next story from the Wall Street Journal. This is shameful reporting by the Journal. It's ridiculous. It's just like, oh, God. It's just – they do stuff like – articles like this are just more like – this is like a consumer help publication. Like, here's how you do it. Wall Street Journal. Student loan forgiveness. Who qualifies for Biden's plan and what it means for borrowers? Oh, do tell. The plan eliminates up to $10,000 in federal loan debt for individual borrowers with annual incomes of under $125,000 or couples who earn less than $250,000. The plan is expected to benefit the majority of more than 43 million people in the U.S. So there you go. Now you see what it's all about votes, who hold a total of $1.6 trillion in debt. In addition to the loan forgiveness, keep in mind, the president will also be extending the pandemic-era student loan pause on payments, so they haven't had to pay for a while. That started in March, and the New York Fed says that's worth separately $200 billion. So you've got all this money that's not going to have to be paid back. And they never answered the question of, well, who's paying for – okay, no, question number one, who's paying for this? Okay. Question number two is, how much does this cost? The Journal article never answers that. Instead, it gives you this little – handy dandy little worksheet for this is what I mean, like it's like a consumer advice, you know, agency. Do I qualify for, look at this ridiculous thing. Start. Do you have, this is like this algorithm here, this little flow chart that tells you, well, you know, if you're eligible, here you go. It's unbelievable. And yet it doesn't answer any basic questions, that article. But yet, you know, it's 43 million people. It answers that question.
Right. I don't know, because I don't understand how many people are eligible and how much it's going to cost.
No one does. But I know that 43 million people are being, you know, sort of bribed with a carrot here. We're going to help you out.
Well, I'm assuming that the administration wants to do this coming into the election.
Of course.
So $10,000. Yeah. And if you look at the places where you have the highest population of student loans, you know, it's in urban Democratic strongholds.
Oh, yeah.
That's what it looks like to me. So,
yeah.
So to me, this is simply buying votes coming into the election. And but what's interesting is if you look at all the people struggling with student debt, and I have to tell you, I have a huge prejudice here. I used to be on the board of Sallie Mae, and I consider most student loans to be fraudulently induced. So to me, if the law was really applied, none of these people owe anybody any money anyway, because
right.
I think it was all fraudulent inducement. So anyway, so that's my sort of prejudice in the whole things. But if you look at the people really struggling with student loan, $10,000 is not going to give them a lot of relief.
No, it's not. No.
Right.
And that's a great point. Like, well, they're fraudulently induced. Okay, so my point is, well, why don't you, if you're so concerned about student debt, why don't you just get rid of the provision that was enacted in 2005 that got that protected it from
right.
bankruptcy?
Exactly.
If students are in such trouble, let them declare bankruptcy.
Right.
Okay. That's
and
a
wipe it out.
That's a constitutionally mandate. That's bankruptcy was written into the Constitution for a reason.
Right.
The founders
right.
knew the creditors were rapacious, but they're not going to deal with that. They're not going to deal with that. They're going to be like, well, how do we convert this? We can't go the constitutional route. Let's go the cronies route so we can reward our friends and punish our enemies. That's the route they're taking.
Well, that's the thing. What the danger here is, the relief will be selective and it will be chosen by type and jurisdiction. It will
yep.
be remarkably woke. This will be woke debt relief.
yep. Yep.
Right.
It's wokenomics.
Right.
Okay.
That's a good one. I have to write that down, John. Wokenomics.
Yep. Wokenomics. You got it right here on the Solari Report. Okay, let's go to Powell's speech. We talked a lot about Powell's speech last week at Jackson Hole.
Speaking of woke economics.
It was 8 minutes long, and we're like, okay, well, which article do we use? Like, forget, it's an eight-minute speech. Go to the speech. Okay, here we go.
Okay.
Right from the Board of Governors. You want to know what he said? Here it is. He says this, quote, "The FOMC's overarching focus right now is to bring inflation back down to our 2% goal." Pretty blunt. "Reducing inflation is likely to require a sustained period of below-trend growth. There will likely be some softening of labor market conditions. And then, while higher interest rates, slower growth, and softer labor market conditions will bring down inflation," here's the key, this is why the market didn't like this, "they will also bring some pain to households and businesses." So there you have it, straight from the horse's mouth. It's going to hurt what we're going to do. We're going to increase rates.
So here's what's interesting. 20 million homes can't pay utility bills. A significant number of small businesses can't pay their rent. But corporate profits are up because they have no problem passing through their costs to consumers. But and now, on top of all of it, corporate profits are up, but we're, according to this, we're in a recession. But let's look at how Powell says the word recession. Go pull that up again. I want to show you.
Yeah, I want to go back to
the economics term for recession.
I want to go to some pretzel talk in this language, in this thing.
Oh, okay, good.
To finish it up. Our responsibility, okay, look here. I love this. Our responsibility to deliver price stability is unconditional.
Oh, my God.
Except when we're printing $4.5 trillion and rewarding to our friends, then it's not so unconditional. Okay. We're not worried about it then. Okay, so here we go. High inflation in the United States. He says, okay, well, we've got
the strong demand.
Yeah. That's why we have high inflation in the U.S. is the product of strong demand and constrained supply. It has nothing, you knave, to do with us printing $4.5 trillion. It perish the thought. Yeah.
Yeah, but we didn't give it to everybody. We only gave it to our friends. So that doesn't create as much inflation as if we gave it to everybody.
Right. Right. So back to the recession, his language for recession. That's a sustained period of below trend growth.
A sustained period of below trend growth is now the new word for, that's woke economics for recession. Oh, God.
Wonder how they describe a depression. You know, same way. It's a sustained period of low trend growth.
You know, I have to tell you, a couple times I've watched recent speeches of Powell where I haven't listened to the words. I'm just looking at the body language.
Yeah.
And each time I look at it, I think, thank God I don't have that job.
Oh.
He looks scared.
Oh, yeah. He doesn't look happy. He's got to deal with a guy like Carsten, too. It's like,
yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah.
Okay, let's keep it going. This next article is really interesting. From a publication, I don't know the markup. Who is collecting data from your car? And they point out right up front, today's cars are akin to smartphones with apps connected to the internet that collect huge amounts of data, some of which are highly personal. The markup has identified 37 companies that are part of the rapidly growing connected vehicle data industry that seeks to monetize such data in an environment with few regulations governing its sale or use. Oh, that sounds lovely.
Uh-huh.
And then they go through all these companies. So OnStar, you kind of know about already. Sirius, yeah, some of those make sense. And then you're just like, well, what is Allstate? The insurance company, yeah, okay. You want to know if people are falling asleep with the wheel, I guess. But then they go down. So they go through all these things, the different players, car manufacturers, vehicle data hubs, navigation companies, insurance companies, telecom operators, all these people. And then they quote some people from these different – these names, by the way, seem fake, all the names in this article. But, you know, I don't have no way of knowing that. But let's go down to – so they quote all these people from the industry who are like, oh, everything's okay. We respect your privacy. And then they go down and they quote this other guy. I love this name. Bennett Cyphers.
He's Can a staff. That possibly be a real name?
That can't be real, right? Cyphers. And look where he works, Cyphers. Cyphers works at the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Like, are you kidding me? Anyway, look what he says. The more different ways that you're being measured in your vehicle, the more likely it is that someone can take a stream of data and use the characteristics of all those different data points to fingerprint a particular user or a particular vehicle. So they know who you are just from the data. Cypher said the amount of personal data collected in combination with lack of regulations for its sale is troubling. When you see the volume of data that's set up for sale and the lack of regulation in the vast majority of American states regarding how companies you can use data, it seems like a match made in privacy hell. Yeah. And I want you to think back to the lead up in the global financial crisis where it's like, well, you're bundling the loans, okay, and you're securitizing the loans, okay. But then you had people taking out insurance policies on the loans, but they weren't insurance policies. They were credit default swaps. And right. You get the same kind of sense here. It's like, well, what are you doing with this data? And who's to prevent you from like making bets on the data? It makes me really nervous reading an article like this.
Well, the other reason it makes you nervous is we've seen more and more stories about people having their car interfered with for covert operations. So,
yep.
It makes me nervous because I think they're real safety issues.
Yeah. In other words, if there comes a point where the sort of the feedback loop kind of closes, and then you got a problem.
Right.
And the feedback loop in the financial industry closed when you had credit default swaps, and suddenly it was like, well, what do you could take insurance policies out on people's loans failing? Yeah, right. You see what I mean? Like, well, right. now suddenly it's in your interest to see people fail in their mortgages.
Right.
You know?
And we've seen that with life insurances where people take out life insurances without someone's permission. And so somebody can make a lot of money if you die.
Companies do that.
Right. Right.
It doesn't violate the insurable interest rule. The insurable interest rule was created in the 1700s. When there was no limitation on who could take out insurance policies. And so what you saw was a bunch of people taking out insurance policies on ships with really a lot of cargo, and then the ship would sink and they'd collect.
So let me tie decarbonizing Sydney with this. The biggest problem here is then going to be central control. Because once you have CBDCs and you've got the smart grid and everything, including your car, if they don't want you going someplace, they can, boom, they just turn off your car.
Yep.
So you're talking about smart metering your card in a way that central control can track and decide where you go and when you go and what time you can go.
Right.
So if we don't want you commuting at 9, we want you commuting at 10, your car won't start.
Yeah.
Or it can't get on that highway.
Yeah. That's where this is headed.
So this is headed towards complete spatial control. That's where it's headed.
Yeah. Complete behavioral control.
Right. Well, can you imagine in your car having to listen to ads?
Oh. that's horrifying.
Or programming, You have an anger management program, so while you're in the car, you have to listen to anger management tapes.
The radio of my car broke. Recently.
Really?
Yeah, they still won't come on. And I'm like, okay, that's fine. I'm good with that.
Yeah, it is. Actually, it is fine.
Roll around in complete silence, talking to myself.
Okay, okay, let's keep going.
Okay.
We need something more cheerful.
Well, the next story is probably not it. It's Mar-a-Lago. We got the raid on Mar-a-Lago. We got to cover this. The DOJ and the FBI just totally out of control. But again, this is a story. It's like, the news stories, I just don't trust you guys. I'm going to go to the affidavit itself.
I would like to point out, I keep being told Trump is raising a fortune off of this. So
I bet.
This is great for his fundraising.
Yeah. It makes sense because the backdrop to this affidavit is interesting. Let's take a look. Okay. This is the affidavit that supposedly provided probable cause for the raid. Okay. And the backdrop is that. Where is it here? I can't highlight it in a PDF. That's why I'm kind of struggling. Trump, okay, they received from Trump, NARA, the Presidential Records Administration, received 15 boxes of records from Trump. 15 boxes has been transported from the former president's office property at Palm Beach to NARA. So that's the backdrop, is that Trump coughs up these records. He provides them. Okay. And then you have this affidavit saying, okay, well, here's what we looked through these 15 boxes and there's a problem. Okay. And you saw just a couple of redactions, but not very many. Okay. And then they get down to this section of the affidavit, probable cause, right here. Okay. Paragraph 24. And then you say, okay, well, okay, let's get in probable cause. What's your probable cause for going and raiding this guy's home? And then you get right away, almost like barely two paragraphs into it, they're like, and then Trump came out and he tweeted something saying that they haven't, the feds haven't found anything. That's basically, I know you can't read the fine print.
Right.
And that this sets off the FBI and the DOJ. They're just like, what is this guy's got no business? It's like, well, do you have probable cause or don't you? What does this have to do with anything? And after this, this Trump tweet here of they haven't found anything, look at the redactions. There you go. Oh, there was a Miami article. We could leave that in. Redacted. Well, here we go. Better redact that. Just redact this. Redact. Keep redacting. Let's keep it going. Keep redacting. Because he said this tweet, this mean tweet. Are you kidding me?
So now, remember, the FBI was down at Mar-a-Lago in June collecting material, right? So Trump's lawyers are there. They're there. They want more stuff. They're there to get stuff, right?
Yeah.
So they were there in June.
Yeah.
Apparently, you know, with the lawyers getting whatever they wanted, right?
Yeah.
So now they're going back. Was the raid in July or August? But, you know, so they're going back in the last month and they won't let Trump's lawyers in. And it's a surprise move.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you my read of what we just saw.
Okay.
So Trump tweets out, you know, you guys, they haven't found anything. That's all he said. It's just standard boilerplate Trump bluster. Of course he's going to say that. They haven't found anything. You know, I'm clean as a whistle. I think the FBI is going to try to use that, like, because he's trying to hide stuff. That's evidence that he hid stuff and he's interfering with the investigation. I guarantee you that's what's behind those redactions.
Okay, so there are two theories, and I told you this earlier. One theory is that Trump declassified documents that prove that the Clintons and the FBI were in cahoots in trumping up the Russian collusion, which we know is true. I mean, it's true.
Right.
The Clinton campaign and the FBI got together and trumped up a case. And we all know that. That's out. But one theory is, okay, he has documents proving that. And he, as president, can declassify them. So if he wants to declassify them and move them to Mar-a-Lago, he can.
Right.
You know, that's the law. That's one. But the other is, and I told you, if that affidavit was signed on August 5th,
okay,
and that's right after the, you know, the main 2 weeks of the Bohemian Grove. And so if they want a criminal prosecution of Trump, the classic way you do it, and I know because I was the target of this, is you do a raid, you don't let their lawyers be there, and you say you found such and such.
Yeah.
All you need is one document.
Right.
You know, and you stuff it in.
Yeah, right.
Or you find some mistake that somebody made.
Right. He's got no record of what they know that. He doesn't have any record of what's in those 15 boxes.
What do you mean? Trump doesn't have a record, or he doesn't have
the 15 boxes. He doesn't have a record of what's in his house. Nobody does.
Right.
I mean, do you have a record of what's in every room
in
your house?
So he can't say that if the FBI says they found the document in his house, he can't prove that they didn't.
Right.
Right. It's the same game they played on me. Exactly.
Yeah.
It's classic.
Yeah. So.
Right.
Anyway.
So.
The dirt, the sleaze of the DOJ and the FBI is right on the surface of the affidavits. Right. Ridiculous.
Right. To do it this way is the height of sleaze.
Yeah.
And the question is, who ordered it? I say it was the Grove that ordered it, because I don't think Garland would do this on his own.
No, I don't think so either.
Right.
These guys are just functionaries. This came from somewhere else, of course. Yeah.
Right. Exactly.
Okay. Let's keep it going in FedWatch. Admitting defeat, the Crown is dropping charges against Freedom Convoy supporters. Now, this is a very kind of slanted article, so you got to read it with the right lens. According to the Democracy Fund, a supporter of the Freedom Convoy 2022, who had their legal team representing in court, they've had charges against them stayed by the Crown. So they weren't exactly dropped. They were stayed. And then the article goes on, from the vague details that TDF has given about the case. So there you see the sort of bias in the writer. The vague details. It sounds like the organization's lawyer, Mr. Gallipo, representing this particular client, had taken a strategy of aggressively pushing the Crown to provide details to back up its charges, which evidently the Crown, could not do. And that's what led to the stay. So that's there's no doubt, even according to the biased writer, that that's a win for the people who engaged in a protest. And the stays usually occur for like, well, we can't resolve something. Let's enter a stay until we can resolve it. For example, Crown, go find that evidence that you don't have. I mean, we'll never have.
There are reports coming out of Canada that the regional authorities have been canceling truck carriers' licenses. So it looks to me like they dropped the charges, but they're going after them in a more underhanded and final way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's an end run, right? The end run around your judiciary is to me, that's like one of the first stories we've seen where the judiciary is fighting back. We've been covering this for weeks, if not months, on Money and Markets, and now the end run has begun with that story. Right. If we don't have that story queued up, we have the judiciary version of the story, but that's something we'll have to keep our eye on in future Money and Markets for sure.
Well, what's interesting is states doing this are pointing out the fact that they have the power to do it.
Yeah.
In other words, they have the power to say JP Morgan Chase can't do business here.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay. Let's keep it going with the next story. I was going to brush off this next story, but then something caught my eye. This is a story about states' rights. Montana has lost its water rights. So I read that. And I'm like, yeah. So go ahead. Tell me more. You know, sure it has. But then I see what caught my eye was this. And I knew it was like, uh-oh. The Hellgate Treaty of 1855. It's like, that sounds like a bunch of nonsense. The Hellgate Treaty of 1855, what are you doing with that? That was a document used to create the Flathead Indian Reservation, okay? The treaty, under Article 3 of the Constitution, stipulates that tribes have the right of taking fish. And this right refers to waters, not to the reservation per se. In order to ensure the quality of where the tribes fish, the water rights in those 11 counties must be placed under tribal government to be administered by the federal government. There we go. We have trouble in paradise. The state of Montana enabled it. So back in 2015, when this first surfaced, the Montana state legislature voted to push the compact forward and reinterpret the 1855 law. So there you go. That's the pretext. And then the thing that it's like, okay, well, this is all I need to see. The cast of characters of this charade includes, get a load of this team of all-stars, the EPA, the DOJ, the Bureau of Indian Affairs, the IRS, the Treasury Department, big trouble, the EPA, and just to round out the batting cleanup here in the All-Stars, the DHS. They're going to enforce compliance.
God.
Yeah. So now I believe that Montana is going to lose its water rights. Now I believe it.
This is scary.
Yeah. Right. You're going,
the
you're going
one
back.
The only thing they didn't have was DOD, and that's DOD's in the game on state of Washington next door.
So let's just review. The feds, they find a statute, a treaty that's 170 years old. They go to the state people. They say, go ahead and reinterpret this. to require feds to administer the water rights, and we'll be good. And that's what happened. And now the DHS is going to enforce whatever the feds do. Yeah, this is the powers that be doubling down and going insane with more and more control as people are waking up.
I used to have people in Montana tell me, you know, if anything goes wrong in Montana, we'll just head to Canada. And I used to try and tell them there is no way.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Okay. Keep it going in FedWatch. This is the next one. I've got mixed emotions about it, but it's got good information in the story, so it's worth covering. A new jailbreak for John Deere tractors rides the right to repair wave. This is from Ars Technica, this article. Okay. The backdrop here is, let me center this. At the DEF CON security conference in Las Vegas on Saturday, the hacker, known as Sick Codes, is presenting a new jailbreak for John Deere and Company tractors that allows him to take control of multiple models through their touchscreens. So vulnerabilities like the ones that Sick Codes found help farmers do what they need to do with their own equipment. Farmers prefer, this is they're quoting Sick Codes now, farmers prefer the older equipment simply because they want reliability. They don't want stuff to go wrong at the most important part of the year when they have to pull stuff out of the ground, Sick Code says. And so that's really the story of the hack here he's presenting to people.
Right. So I can't tell you how irritating it was. In the 90s, you would see farmers going crazy because they literally were not allowed to fix their own own tractors.
Yeah.
And they were trying to pull the Terminator seed so they couldn't save their own seed. And of course, what this does is that puts them, both the seed and the tractors, and models where all their profits can be siphoned off. So this is there's a group in Missouri that is teaching people how to build their own tractors.
Yeah.
And it's literally reached the point where if you're going to be a farmer, you might as well sit down and learn how to build your own tractor than deal with these guys.
Right.
No, because they're just, you know, it's all central control. Everything comes with the sock and the jaw. So,
yeah.
It's called open source ecology. If you're a farmer and you want to learn how to make your own tractor, there you go.
I think the Amish could make a mint right now just by holding classes on how to do it the Amish way.
Right.
You know?
Right.
Farming without the feds, you know?
Right. Well, if you look at open source ecology was also teaching home building. And if you look at all the fraud in the home building and the mortgage system, if you're a young couple, I'd learn how to build your own house.
Yeah.
It's easier.
But then you still have to get all the permits and whatnot. So.
Yeah, that's true.
You know.
That's true.
Okay.
But, you know, there's a difference between Tennessee and where there's no... I have no zoning in my community, so.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah.
That's nice.
You know, we don't all live in California.
Yeah, right. Okay, let's go to CBDC and crypto. We only have one story in CBDC and crypto this week, but this is a massive story. This is really important. FedNow to launch by mid-2023, Bowman says. So Michelle Bowman is a member of the Fed Board of Governors. And there's two things to note about this story, the two very important takeaways here. FedNow, Fed Governor Michelle Bowman said last week the new system will be available by mid-2023. So that's right around the corner. Bowman said FedNow may fulfill some of the benefits that have been suggested could be derived from another potential payments innovation, namely CBDC. So FedNow is sort of like a junior varsity version of CBDC. This indicates that the Fed is definitely serious about CBDC.
Right.
FedNow is expected to, so one takeaway is this is part of CBDC. Another is FedNow is expected to make faster payments more widely available in the U.S. through a government-backed payment system operating 7 days a week, 24 hours a day. Such an instant payment system already exists. It already exists in the form of RTP network, which is operated by the bank-owned clearinghouse. How about that? So in other words, FedNow is going to compete. The government-owned thing is going to compete with the banks themselves. Remember
this is going to cut the float tremendously.
Yeah. In other words, the Fed is the regulator of the banks, and now it is the competitor of the banks. And FedNow, what will it do? So what's the big deal with FedNow? It will enable financial institutions of every size and in every community across America to provide safe and efficient instant payment services. So what they're doing, what this, if you read it between the lines here, the article doesn't really make it express. They're talking about settlement. That's right. The big thing. Like I said, a debt-based economy, for one bank to settle with another, there has to be a settlement mechanism. And this FedNow is providing that. This is a major step on the way to CBDC.
And it's providing it very, very quickly. When I first went to Wall Street, you know what the number one source of profits for Wall Street was?
No.
Float. So if you had a Merrill Lynch account and you sold, let's say you sold $10,000 of IBM stock, you would literally get a check from the Bank of Hawaii that would take you, you would deposit it, and it would take you 10 to 24 days to get your money.
Yeah.
Because Merrill Lynch was making, 10 to 24 days of float on your money.
Yeah.
It's unbelievable.
Yeah. Right. Wow. Wow. That's an eternity. That's unbelievable. Anyway. Okay, but that's a big story. FedNow. We'll circle back to that one for sure. I was kind of stunned by that one. But let's go to Farmageddon.
Okay.
First story of Farmageddon, very interesting. This is from the Telegraph in the UK. This sort of like the insider baseball story. Rishi Sunak is just the start. Rishi Sunak being their Treasury Secretary, former Treasury Secretary, the Chancellor of the Exchequer. Sunak is just the start. The great lockdown scandal is about to unravel. And this journalist, Fraser Nelson, you can see there at the top, says, I have been trying to persuade Sunak to go on record about what really happened in the lockdown. Only a handful of people really know what took place then, because most ministers, including members of the cabinet, were kept in the dark. Government was often reduced to a quad of ministers deciding on Britain's future, and the then Chancellor of Exchequer, Sunak, was one of them. The culture of fear seen in Orwellian advertising campaign that sought to terrify the country also applied inside the government. Lockdown, Sunak says, was always a political decision, but number 10, Downing Street, wanted to dress it up as following the science. And then he goes on, and it's not just Sunak. As one cabinet minister told me yesterday, it wasn't just Rishi. I needed my own network of spies to find out what was happening in the lockdown because we were never told. So now the truth is starting to come out.
Right.
That it was never about the science. It was always about fear. And it was a tight group of people that was controlling the situation in the government.
I just saw a report, and I haven't had a chance to follow up on it, that the Brits are planning on providing compensation to people who were vaccine injured. Now, if that is the case, and I haven't had a chance to follow up on it, somebody is really scared. I mean, that's a much stronger statement than $10,000 in student loans.
Yeah, right, right.
Right.
Good point.
Right.
Yeah.
There seems to be a surprising amount of fear. You know, you've had the establishment throughout the Western world just double down on the lies until literally, when Fauci is fired. And now suddenly it's as though, it's almost like the waves are receding.
Uh-huh.
And, we're watching the dead fish flop on the beach, and people are getting nervous. So, and you're seeing a lot of effort to provide excuses for the people at the CDC and the FDA. They were part of a mass hysteria. We can't hold them accountable for what they did. So, somewhere inside the bureaucracy, there's a lot of fear.
Yeah, what gets me about that Telegraph story is it's like, well, you heard him say there's only four people in the government who really knew what the score was about COVID. That's a small number. You just go to each of the four and say, hey, who'd you talk to?
Well, and one of the reasons this is so unusual is the fellow who's being this is attributed to is just, he's just been in a competition to be named the head of the Conservative Party. So,
right.
You're talking about a kind of politics can affect really who's in control right now. So You know, you've always said, I always quote you, John Titus says Fauci's a chew toy.
Yeah.
And they have literally, you know, somebody rang a bell and said, okay, now it's cool to get Fauci.
Yeah.
So we saw a hit piece from Megyn Kelly. And I looked at it and I said, oh, they rang the bell. Now it's time, you know, throw Fauci. He's the chew toy. Throw him to the, you know, and now everybody's going to dump on Fauci.
Yeah.
And it's.
Yeah, eventually the chew toy gets ripped apart. That's the end of the chew toy. And you bring in another chew toy.
Right. But as everyone watches it, what that means is cascading fear down to the bureaucracies because they don't have protection now.
Oh.
Right?
Yeah. Right.
They were just following the leader. Now that that leader's gone, then the question is, okay, who are we following now? Who's going to protect us?
Right.
Right.
Yeah. Right. Okay. Next story of Farmageddon. This next story is as horrifying as it is short, which is very. This is from Meryl Nass. No clinical trials, no advisory committee, newly formulated boosters to be injected starting in 10 to 12 days. Yes, 3 days ago. So 3 days ago, Pfizer asked for permission to inject these shots into people for the first time to perform a clinical trial. And now, before 2 weeks goes by, our federal government tried to pull out all the stops and inject all of us with this experimental potion without a single clinical trial. So warp speed has gone turbo.
Right. And the interesting thing about it is they can't say it's safe and they can't say it's effective. So the question is, okay, what's the goal?
Yeah.
What are they trying to get into our bodies and why? Which goes back to what I said in March of 2020. What are the secret ingredients and what are they trying to get in our body?
Yeah, right. I don't know.
So, but for a doctor like Meryl Nass, she's in a state of shock because they're approving vaccines without a logical scientific justification for why.
They're like, just take an undisclosed substance provided by a convicted felon and just inject it into your system. And we're cool with that.
Well, but it gets even better. The headline we're not going to discuss today, I'm bringing it up now, is the Rockefeller Foundation has just awarded a grant of $7 million to see what they can do to improve the behavioral acceptability and uptake of COVID injections. So I don't know if you have you seen the book called Nudge? It's all about how you can manipulate people, you know. Oh, if you take the injection, you can be with your friends. Or if you take the injection, then you won't be responsible for murdering your grandparents when they get COVID from you, you know. So it's all, but can you imagine $7 million to come up with behavioral manipulations to get people to take an injection that's never been through a human trial and nobody can explain to you why they want you to take it?
Right, yeah.
That's going to be a very interesting study.
I would love to read that one. Yeah, I want to read it too, yeah.
Okay.
Well, let's go to pushback, though. We have a lot of stories on tap today, half dozen. So let's just get into it. There's some good ones today.
Whittled down from 1,000.
Whittled down from a long list.
Right.
So we just wanted to have the ones where sort of the stories have teeth or the teeth are about to leave a mark. But here they are. Number one from ABC 7 News in the Bay Area. Bay Area School District rescinds mask mandate after sending 4-year-old home for not having mask on. Well, how would they know about that? Well, the reason they know about it is there was a video of this. This guy shot a video. This parent goes into this Mountain View Wisman School District had required masks since school started a week ago. Cell phone video of the 4-year-old Mountain View boy shows him unable to go inside his school at one point because he doesn't have his mask on, okay? The video was recorded Thursday morning. Okay, that's all it took. Thursday morning, the video is recorded. And then that night at the district school board meeting on Thursday night, a sudden change in the mask policy as Superintendent Rudolph addressed the COVID-19 policy. We are now in the medium tier. So starting tomorrow, we are now in the masks optional for students, said the superintendent. Isn't that great? Cell phone video in the morning.
Right.
They buckle that evening.
Right. That is good.
Yeah, because he knows what's going to happen with that video. They're going to take it to ABC7.
Now, who took the video?
A parent.
The parent was, okay, yeah. The parent was with the child when it happened.
Yeah, was with the child. They show him getting turned away. And the dad's like, hey, I got this video. I guess I'm going to run on down to my local news agency. And out goes the mask policy that night.
Yeah, that's
they
good.
They figured that one out fast. That's great. That shows you how real activism on the ground is effective.
Exactly.
Boy, love that story. Okay, let's keep it going. First American Legal. A coalition of attorneys general led by Oklahoma implement key plank of strategy to stop erosion of sovereignty to the WHO. I love this. This is at the state level. A coalition of state attorneys general. You had Oklahoma there. You also have Alabama, Arizona, a lot of states. I mean, just look at a long list, mostly southern, but also some western states, formerly petitioned the Biden administration to remove an Obama-era rule that allowed the Department of Health and Human Services to cede American sovereignty to the World Health Organization, and this is key, when determining whether a public emergency exists. So Obama's like, hey, wouldn't it be great if the WHO could just bypass the U.S. law, just declare emergencies itself? Today, Oklahoma Attorney General John O'Connor, along with a strong coalition of other attorney generals, formally filed a petition with the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services demanding that it formally remove those problematic regulations. They do everything by regulation, these criminals, from the Code of Federal Regulations. So they're asking for something very specific here, the Attorney General saying, get this out. This is no business in the CFR.
So this is really important because they are trying to engineer the WHO announcing a pandemic that could then cut through all U.S. laws and engineer right down to the ground. And the state OGs are saying no. The other guy who's saying no is Senator Ron Johnson has a bill in saying that any such provision would rise to the level of a treaty and require Senate approval, which, of course,
exactly.
Never gonna get.
You've kind of just saw that story. That's a great point, is that you have essentially a treaty is being implemented through a regulation passed by the pen of one former president.
Right. So I don't know if you remember this, but you came in on the Geneva press conference. Yeah. And the goal of the attorneys in Europe who were holding that press conference and bringing people in was to try and warn everyone, like the AGs, that the WHO is really working to engineer such an effort. And of course, it was with the help of the Biden administration. It got rolled back when we did the press conference. But they're working away in committees to try and come up with a way to do this. Yeah. So it's important you stop it now. You nip it in the bud. So good for them.
Good for them. Yeah. Good. The word's getting out.
Right.
Okay. Keep it going on pushback. Here we go. From you know, notice that the first story we had about the parent, that was from Mountain View or whatever, California.
Right.
If you're getting pushback in California, you're making some headway. So let's keep our eye on California. Next up,
San Francisco.
San Francisco. I mean, getting pushback in San Francisco. Gotta be kidding me. San Francisco shop owners threaten to stop paying taxes unless city tackles crime and homelessness. Okay. This is from they're quoting the Chronicle here. For years, business owners in San Francisco's Castro district have complained to the city officials that homeless people struggling with mental illness and drug addiction have wreaked havoc on the neighborhood. Now, merchants say the situation has gotten so bad that they're threatening to possibly stop paying city taxes and fees. And they quote a guy as saying, if the city can't provide the basic services for us businesses to become successful, then what are we paying for? And they're threatening to withhold their money. That's great.
So I told you it's going to come down to taxes. It's going to come down to taxes at at the state level and the federal level. It's going to come down to taxes because you cannot pay, you know, paying a criminal enterprise that's destroying you is called extortion. It's not taxation.
Right.
There's a difference between taxation and extortion, and we've now crossed the line into extortion.
Yep. That's a great point. Yep.
Yep.
That's a great point. Okay. In pushback. Meanwhile, in San Diego, this is from the Defender, Judge Greenlight's lawsuit challenging San Diego's vaccine mandate for employees. Now, this one, this lawsuit has been filed. And the city tried to dismiss it. Okay. The judge has said it's going to go forward. So the defendants, the city, brought a motion to dismiss the case. Okay. And the judge says, nope, it's going forward. He rejected the city's request to dismiss the complaint. Predictably, the city cited the U.S. Supreme Court trying to dismiss this, saying, no, no, we can have this mandate because the Supreme Court in 1905 decided Jacobson versus Massachusetts, a case that pertained to mandatory smallpox vaccination. So get rid of the case, the argued the city. And the judge is like, no, 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 that's not going to work here. He says that argument does not directly address the allegations made in the plaintiff's lawsuit challenging the city's restrictions. Oh, do tell. What is different this time? And the difference is, in the plaintiff's case now, who are trying to get rid of this mandate, the data shows that currently available vaccinations do not prevent transmission or infection, and the city has been unable to present any credible authority supporting its position that it has the legal right to require elected officials and so on to have proof of vaccination. So the key thing is here, the vaccinations do not prevent transmission or infection, and that's in the data. And without that, you don't have any grounds to support this vaccine
mandate.
There's
way too much data that's now come in.
Yep.
There's no scientific reason. And that's why what Meryl Nass was saying about this new approval, there's no trials, there's no data to support it, and nobody can explain why they want, as you would say, a serial criminal to be able to inject mysterious secret ingredients into your arm.
Yep. Yeah.
Yep.
But that's, you know, if you can't get a judge in San Diego to go with you, you have lost your ass. I mean, it is over.
Right.
You know.
That's a very, you know, I hadn't thought of that, John, but you're right.
Really? The San Diego judge has been presented with the 1905 Supreme Court case written by Oliver Wendell Holmes Jr., right?
Yeah.
There's this jurist, and the judge in San Diego is like, nope, that's not good enough.
You know? Right. And usually, you know, judges don't like to have to be called upon to decide the science.
Right.
So for a judge to say, well, you don't have scientific backing.
Yep. They hate that. The thing they hate deciding most is that someone's lying to them. They'll dance all around that one. But the science is second for sure. Okay. Meanwhile, in California church that defied COVID restrictions wins court battle. A blessing for the First Amendment. So the person being quoted here in this story is the attorney. I'll just point that out now. A California appeals court dropped nearly $200,000 in fines for a San Jose church that came under fire for this is back up in San Francisco region. That came under fire for violating COVID-19 restrictions on indoor gatherings during the height of the pandemic. The attorney's name, I circled up there, Mariah Gondero. The Supreme Court has been very clear over the last year that these orders violated the First Amendment. This is a religious freedom case, and they violated the First Amendment because they discriminated against religion, she said. Then they go on in the story. So they won the $200,000 case, but the article points out here. There's one more little piece to this story that I want to focus in on. So they win the $200,000 case, but the article points out the legal struggles for the McClures are not over. The county is still attempting to slap him with $2.8 million fine for the pandemic era violations. So it's like, well, what's going on here? And it's not really clear, but the attorney says, Gondera said she expects the church to have complete victory in that case as well. So it sounds like there were two cases and that they won the first one, the smaller of the two, and now having won that first one, it's going to apply to the whole enchilada and the whole thing is going down. But that's a win either way.
It's a huge win and good for them for fighting because a lot of churches have not fought. They've rolled over.
Yep. Boy, okay. So the final story, which is not in California, and it's not really a farmer-related story, but it is pushback, is this. Over 1,000 scientists and professionals signed formal declaration there is no climate emergency. So we're looking ahead to now that pharma has been kind of – it's gone sideways for the powers that be. Climate is next. And the article points out here, remember relatively early on in the COVID pandemic, cycle, leading infectious disease experts created the Great Barrington Declaration. Indeed, they did. And ultimately, the Great Barrington Declaration prevailed, as we're now seeing this week. And this article says, perhaps it is time to consider if the World Climate Declaration, which has been signed by 1,200 climate scientists and professionals, may be something to seriously consider itself, promote, and act on. In the document, these scientists affirm there is no climate emergency. And then they go through all their reasons like, well, that's just all a bunch of nonsense. But that's basically that story. Is the same groundswell of resistance is showing up early on among people who have a reason to know.
Well, it's funny, now that you have a huge portion of the population that have come to the realization that the lies on pandemic were that complete and bad.
Yeah.
They're starting to realize, you know, because before, when you try to tell everybody how bad the lies were on the climate emergency, they just couldn't fathom, you know, sort of a global conspiracy that ridiculous.
Yeah, right.
And now they're realizing, oh, we do have ridiculous global conspiracies. Okay, this could be another one, you know.
Right.
So right. The worm is turned not just on the pandemic. The worm is turned on all major global big lies.
Well, the jury is still kind of out on climate. That's, you know, I never thought you'd get the people you did get on board with masks, and I was sorely disappointed.
Right, right. So, well, you know, Germany is now saying in a month they're going back to masking the unvaccinated.
I know, I know. And we'll touch on that. We'll touch on that in a bit. Yeah.
I'm going to have to drive through France to get to Switzerland now.
I'd do it. I would do that. Yep.
Yeah. I've done it before.
Right.
I've done it before. Okay. Keep going.
All right. Let's go to charts. It's time for charts. Okay. Done with pushback on the charts. You ready?
Yep.
Let's hit it. Dollar. Here we go.
Dollar touched 109. It's back down to 108.5, but it touched 109. So, you know, the debt trap is a world hurt all around the world.
Yeah.
So one of the reasons the Chinese treasury could be going down is, you know, they're having to pay dollar debt.
Yeah.
Yeah. Great. So the point. Squeeze is on.
The squeeze is on. Okay.
Squeeze is on.
This is another good one.
Yeah. And so Europe, you know, Europe hurting. So Europe is now at parity with the dollar. And that's a big swing, as you can see from the chart.
Yeah, so, well, this put number on it. It's 84 here, and it's, you know, 101 here.
Right.
That's a
big swing. And remember, this is a year chart.
Yeah.
You know, you go back, the euro was trading as much as 120. Against the dollar. So it's been much bigger than that.
Yeah. Okay.
So, and the euro, the thing to understand is the euro is the only competitor to the dollar for reserve currency status. You know, if you're going to take real market share away from the dollar, it's the euro that had the ability to do it. So now the euro is losing that ability, and it just makes the dollar more dangerous and dominant. So,
yes. Yeah. Good point. Okay. S&P, gold, silver, TLT.
So this is just the same look we do at how some of the major markets are moving. And again, bonds are in the doghouse. So at the very bottom, that's the 20-year Treasury ETF down 21% comparing to the S&P, which is down 16%. So we are in a major correction. There's no doubt about that. Gold and silver, you know, gold's down 4.62%, silver down 19%. And as I say, the more it drops, I just keep buying. So,
you know what that chart reminds me of? It reminds me of 2008.
Yeah, it does kind of feel like that.
And yeah, I tell you why. Because in January 2008, I dumped all my stocks. I liquidated everything. There's trouble coming, and I turn around and I put basically the majority of that money back into gold. Into precious metal. And I, you know, it wasn't a big gainer that year. It was maybe 5%, maybe 10% that year, but it didn't lose 40% like the rest of the market did.
Right.
And that's what this chart is. It's like, well, gold, it's down 5%, but it's a big winner because it hasn't lost as much as the other guys.
So every month I keep buying a little bit of stocks, but I use hedged equity. So I've got a hedge against a big drop, which, you know, and I appreciate the correction could turn into a bear, it could get much worse. You know, and I like gold, but right now I like silver much more because the silver, the gold-silver ratio is just historically very attractive.
I don't know what to say about, you know, those things are so
manipulated. Well, here's the thing to say is, why would anybody buy a bond?
Yeah, right.
I mean, that's the, you know, so if you look at a chart of sort of when we go from, you know, from a tech phase to a commodity phase, we're just turning up into a, I think, a bull market for commodities, no matter how much Powell raises the interest rates. And, I just don't see why anybody would be in fixed income. And I think any, you know, you have so many people in a 50-50 or 60-40 portfolio in the theory their bonds were going to protect them when the stock market turned. And as you can see, it ain't working and it's not going to work.
Yeah.
So get ready to get real. You know, whatever you're in, you want to be real. And, you know, there are stocks in the stock market that are real and there are stocks that aren't. So just make sure you're in the real sector.
Good advice. Okay. Here we go.
Well, what Powell can say is it's working.
Is it ever?
Yeah, interest rates, jacking up interest rates really do work.
Yeah, you know, and I can't put a number on it, but it looks like to me the red is getting redder. I mean, that's minus.
Yep.
You know, you've got some minus 35.
Well, you should have.
Minus,
did you get the 1 year chart? You can see how much redder it's getting.
Yeah. Well, let's just see. Here you go.
Yeah. Yep. So that's the 1 year. Sorry, that's year to date.
Yeah.
And you can see the last three
months.
No,
no. You know what? It's not year to date. This label.
It's the 1 year.
It's 1 year.
Yeah. 1 year. That's what I thought. I'd asked for 1 year. So.
Yeah. That's my label. I did it wrong.
Okay.
This is the right level.
So what you can see is, look at that jump from 1 year to the last 3 months.
Yeah, right. So it's 20s right here. Yeah. But if you go to the previous chart, it's 28 to 43. You know, those are big numbers.
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
Wait, go back to the 3 month. I just want to see where silver is on the 3 month.
Silver, where are you, silver?
Yeah, was it? It was at the complete bottom. Oh yeah, there it is.
Where?
Yeah.
Yeah,
it's down. It's come back up a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Still in the red. Okay. Here you go. 30-year Treasury yield.
Interest rates rising, and if Powell's right, you know it's we're going back. We haven't seen the high yet. That's what it looks like to me.
If it sure sounded that way to his speech. Like he's weird. He says inflation's non-negotiable unless we're giving out money.
Well, here's the problem. If he, you know, I think what Powell's worried about is losing control.
Yeah, I think that's what he's worried about too. I think I think he reads those stories like 20% of people can't make their utility payments, Jay. You better get this under control. You know, they're not going to be able to pay for their food either. And they're coming to your house. You know, I think he knows. Yep. Okay. Yeah. So he's getting it under control. Here's the 10-year yield. Basically the same thing. Almost
same
very
story.
Hard. Same
Those
story.
Those charts look very similar.
Boy, they do. Don't they look at that? I'm going to fade from 30-year to 10-year. Barely different. Yeah. Any difference?
Yep.
Wow. What does that mean when the 30-year looks exactly like the 10-year?
So, you know, the danger is you get an inverted curve. So they're trying to stop an inverted curve. So if your short-term rates are higher than your long-term rates.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's why, you know, we showed that chart that says, okay, we could run into real trouble in January. Because
it's like backwardation in the metals market.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Let's keep it going. Next up, the first of two charts from, what is it? Statista.
Right, so they're really pushing the electric cars and the electrification, and so I wanted to take a look at who's marketing electric cars.
Yeah.
So you can see we've got Tesla's number two, and then two Chinese firms, one of which is a joint venture with General Motors.
Yeah.
So the Chinese and Asia are really in the lead, and then you've got the German companies, Volkswagen, BMW, Mercedes.
The German trifecta right here.
Right. So there's the, the Chinese, the German, and the Americans are in a real food fight for this market. Then of course, at the bottom, you've got the Koreans.
Yeah, that's an interesting graphic.
Right. Okay. I did not realize until I looked at this that the Chinese were that much in the lead.
Yeah,
I've been looking at Chinese stock car companies that their market caps have been growing like gangbusters.
No kidding.
Yep.
Wow. It still doesn't seem like that many cars, though. 640,000.
No, it doesn't. It's just, but if you look at the technology of getting, you know, of creating a good car and getting the economics tight, you know, having this kind of lead given all the mandates is going to put the Chinese in a great position to win this market.
Yeah, boy. Speaking of Chinese, let's go back to the stock market. We saw that story earlier about delistings. Let's look at this.
Right. So this is the number of companies listed as of 2021. And as you can see, NASDAQ has got the most. So right now, the market, it's down from about 2 trillion to a little bit 1.3 trillion market cap of Chinese stocks.
Yeah.
On American exchanges. And, you know, so if this situation, if the settlement doesn't work, you could see a lot of investors really hurt.
Yeah. In other words, if that, the delisting settlement.
Right.
Yeah. It'd be like Russia. You know, the Russian investors.
This is big money and a lot of people could get really hurt. So
yeah.
When you're looking at Chinese companies, beware.
Yeah. And again, it won't be the insiders. You know, they're never, because they're controlling
it. Right.
You know?
Right.
Okay. Let's go ready to previous wrap-ups and Solaria events, Solaria announcements, I guess.
Okay.
Let's hit it. Coming Thursday, what do we got?
So the interview this week is Pete Kennedy and I. We did this in the second quarter wrap-up. Franklin and I looked at, you know, what can you ask your state and local legislators to do, particularly your state? And that's what we're watching. We're watching the state legislators and the state AGs really, you know, try and bring the conditions of sovereignty. So we went through it on the second quarter wrap-up, but Pete gave me a wonderful list for the food area. And he's worked with a lot of state legislators, you know, on local food systems and what the states can do. So I said, Pete, we need to do this again. We need to do one interview. We need to make it public. And we need to really walk through what state legislators can do. You talk food, I'll talk money, and we'll just go back and forth. And Pete and I were in the middle of it. It was amazing. I'm sitting there and I'd written out a list of all the different things state legislators can do. And it's on a pages document and it's sort of 3 pages of, you know, it's a list with text in it. And I'm sitting there, John, and the page disappears, not the file, but literally all the text on the page just disappears.
What do you mean disappears?
It just disappears. I'm sitting staring at the file. I'm going down the list. I'm describing it verbally as I'm going down the file. I'm just sitting there and all the text in the document just disappears.
So the program page is still up on your computer.
Yeah, it's like a Word document.
The page of it is still up. The page isn't.
The document's still up. The page is still up. And all the text just magically disappears.
There's no black text. That's just gone.
It's just like that. It just evaporated. It's never happened to me before. Now, I knew I knew everything by heart. So it didn't, you know, it didn't interrupt. And Pete was very kind. He said, I have a printout of it here. So I'd send him the file, but I thought that was anyway. So that's my intuition that it's probably something that's pretty good. You know, the power of the state legislators to make a huge difference here is not to be underestimated.
Yeah. Wow. No kidding. Yeah. Okay. Let's keep it going. This one's from me. This is just a Substack. I have a Substack called 2 Weeks to Flatten Your Country. I put a video up. That you can see, it's the first one I did on Rumble. I started a Rumble account and I put a video up there. It's really, it's a speech the presentation I gave at Doctors for COVID Ethics 4th Symposium. So a lot of Solari subscribers have seen it before, but just, you know, this is in sort of a cleaner form. The video that's up on Rumble from Doctors for COVID Ethics 4th Symposium is about 7 hours long. Right. And this is just, anyway, my own thing. So I put it up on Rumble. Now I've got a Rumble account. I've got 100 subscribers on Rumble. Yay.
So here's the thing. If everyone goes and signs up for your Substack account, it means whenever you put up a video, they can get a notification. Now, we'll notify them during Money and Markets, but this way it's more convenient. They get an email notification.
It gets around, again, I've covered this a couple of weeks ago. YouTube has not been notifying my subscribers. Right. And so it's like, well, okay, I'm going to end run around you with a Substack for people who are interested. And that was really the original intent.
Right.
Anyway. Right. Okay. Let's keep it going. Braggins. I love this. The Braggins.
Peter and Ginger Braggin came out with a story on Robert Malone, who is the person who's been taking the Desmet material of mass formation and adding the word psychosis. And he's also written two Substacks on basically why these theories should be used to forgive anybody at the CDC or FDA who broke the law. You know, or who was led to vaccine injuries, their decisions that led to vaccine injuries. And then he also did a Substack that is basically taking really mean pot shots at anybody who thinks there is a conspiracy. And, you know, they're odd pieces because they're kind of, I don't know, I would describe them as, a little bit incoherent in feeling. Uh-huh. Anyway, but so the Braggins really took on Malone for this weaponization of mental health and wrote a great piece and then did two interviews, one on American Out Loud and the other with Jeremy Nell of Germ Warfare, who does our cartoons. So as you can see, there's a cartoon at the top from Jeremy. And I think they're doing, I think their criticisms are to be taken very, very seriously.
Yeah.
So we also put up a blast from the past about how mental health has been weaponized historically. You know, it was used in Russia. It was used in China. It's been used in America. We put up a movie of the week this week about how psychiatry has been abused. And Peter Braggin has been the leader in stopping abuse in psychiatry and has done great work. There's nobody who knows this better. And Peter's watching what's happening with this use of mental health to excuse. And he's saying, ooh, be careful. Now, I would warn people that there's a real effort.
Be careful because it's a two-edged sword.
Right, right. And you know, we've watched a real push to take away people's guns based on mental health.
Yeah.
And I've had several people who have gone recently just for, you know, their 1 year annual checkup and literally had a doctor ask them 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 times, are you depressed? And each time they say no and just finally have to say, look, I'm not, you know, I came here to check my heart health.
Yeah.
I'm not here for, you know. And so there's a real effort to get people to put on the record that they have a mental health problem. And I assure you that will be used to, you know, get control or do something, you know, take away your guns or do something else. So be very, very careful what you let any doctor write down on you on a form. You know, do not engage with these guys on mental health.
Yeah, don't engage. Right. Do not give them what they want.
Right.
You know.
They're working up to all sorts of different control games using this. So don't play that game with them.
Don't play that game. Asked and answered is the response. Okay. The last story. This is very interesting, the backstory on this. Talk about this.
Yeah. So a year ago, CJ Hopkins asked me if he could come to Stavoren, and he brought along Oval Media to film something. His vision was Dinner with Andre. Have you ever seen the movie Dinner with Andre?
No, never saw it.
So Dinner with Andre is a cult, has a huge cult following. CJ used to live in New York. I used to live in New York. We're basically think of ourselves as sort of ex-New Yorkers. Anyway, so this is a cult movie in New York, and it's about, I think they were sitting at Café des Artistes, two famous actors sitting around talking about how the world really works, you know, what's really behind the carpet, what's behind the great Oz. So they sit there and they talk about this for 2 hours at dinner. So his idea was we have dinner at André, but we do breakfast, lunch, and dinner. So, you know, CJ's a very intense guy, is an intense guy to talk to. So Robert Duper, my Dutch partner, and I decided that we would rent an old clipper ship and we would do breakfast. We would take CJ and the crew sailing, and then we would do the breakfast on the ship. So in fact, they're rolling it. CJ has been editing it for a year, and they're rolling it out now in four parts between now and October, the end of October. So it'll roll out in four parts. They just put up part one, and it's
So that's
basically
this.
The conversation is we need to talk about Mr. Global. And one of the reasons I love this title is I keep telling people we don't have a financial problem. We don't have an economic problem. We don't have a political problem. We have a governance problem.
Right, you know, we do.
We have a secret governance, you know, every quarter we do unanswered questions in the Salir Report. And my unanswered question is, okay, who's Mr. Global and why is Mr. Global behaving the way he does? And another way to say it, you know, I've been talking a lot about the BIS. If you look at the BIS powers to hold and move and circulate deposits, they can do it for themselves. They can do it for their members, or they can do it for other. Who's other? So I have a feeling that, you know, who's other on the BIS and who's Mr. Global? There's a connection there. Anyway, but we do need to talk about the governance system. And one of the great contributions, of course, is the hard copy wrap-up we just published where you wrote Sovereignty. I just got an email from Christine Borgensen, who is a very talented, capable journalist, you know, and came out of mainstream media at the very top. And she just got the Sovereignty piece and she said, oh my God, I'm reading Sovereignty. This is just absolutely epic. So that's the new description, epic. You're epic, John. Anyway, we do need to talk about Mr. Global, and the first part is up. You can link to it from Soleri, and the other three parts will roll out between now and the end of October.
But there's another piece to the story, which is that the day after this is put up on Mr. Global, his book, he gets a notification from German's Amazon, like, oh, your book violates German law. We're taking it down from Amazon.
Right. And get this. Yesterday, he heard this. He got the same thing from Amazon Netherlands. So now they've taken it down in the Netherlands. Yeah. And that's shocking to me because, you know, the Netherlands is a pretty sort of calm
It's shocking
place.
And it's not shocking. Yeah, it's Netherlands, but it is, drum roll please, Amazon.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So Amazon Germany, Amazon Netherlands. We'll see if they get to Amazon US.
Yeah, we'll see. Right, right.
Right.
Okay. Well, that is it for Money and Markets, at least the stories and the coverage of visuals.
Well, I don't know. You know, our theme was the blinkers are coming off.
Yeah.
You know, we could say the blinders are coming off. There feels like so much friction.
Yeah.
And the good news is the blinkers are coming off. The bad news is that means there's a lot of friction. And from everything I can see, John, the friction's going to just keep rising. So
it would appear so, yeah. As the powers that be, the financial powers that be, just go berserk with these regulations and this control. They are absolutely out of control now.
Yep.
Yep.
Yep. Well, once you can't even, I mean, 21 trillion missing, then you institute FASB 56, and then you institute even no disclosure of military transfers and expenditures. That's pretty out of control.
Yeah, but thankfully there's a judiciary that's reacting to this and checking a lot of what's going on, doing what it can. It appears to me that way.
Well, the AGs and the judiciary.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Right. So the state level and the judiciary, they're holding the line right now.
everybody needs to ask the question, what can we do to help them?
Yeah. Well, the other thing, you know, the story we saw, the act of the parents with the cell phone video checking the school board, you know, push back. That works.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know?
Each one of us in our life, and of course, use cash.
Yep. Use cash. You got it.
Use cash.
Yep.
Okay, John, I'll talk to you next week. Have a great week.
Thanks, Catherine. I'll see you next week.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining us on Money and Markets. Have a great week.